From WBUR in Boston, it's Weekly Warm-Up, a sampling of the cornucopia of stories and interviews featured on Only a Game, sports public radio style.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new turbocharged Acura RDX with available voice-activated navigation. More at acura.com/RDX.
Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
I look forward to the beginning of each baseball season for lots of reasons, the most powerful of which is that it means I'll soon be talking once again to Tim Kirkjian. For many years, Tim has been Only a Game's Major League Baseball guy. He's funny, smart, and so exceptionally well-informed that it's scary. In his new book, Is This a Great Game or What?, Tim has collected some of the best baseball stories that have come his way as he's covered the game for ESPN, ESPN.com, ESPN Radio, and, of course, Only a Game. When we spoke this week, I began by asking Tim whether he kept a notebook of stories or whether he was able to remember everything that he'd ever heard about the game.
Most of that stuff came off the top of my head, most of it. Now, I did...
This is scaring me.
I'm a strange guy, Bill. I've told a lot of these stories at cocktail parties. I've written them in newspapers and in the magazine, but a lot of them were just kind of stuck in my head. They just had to find a place, you know, once and for all here for all this stuff I had. I didn't use every story I had, but I used close to all of them. I did re-research a lot of things that I wrote over the years, and I did spot things that I said, wow, I forgot about that. Even though I wrote it, I researched it. But overall, most of this came right out of my own head.
Some people may think that as a baseball guy and collector of baseball stories, you have the ultimate great job. On the other hand, you write in the book, quote, "My wife thinks I'm an idiot." Why is that?
Well, she thinks I'm an idiot because every morning I get up at 5:30 in the morning and read the box scores, which I think a lot of adult males and females do, but I do it. And then when I'm done, you know, looking at the box scores, then I write down every game played that the night before, who won, who lost, who hit two home runs in a game. And then when that little exercise is over, then I cut out every box score, which I have for the last 18 years, and I tape them into my box score book, and I carry them around with me wherever I go. And again, my wife looks at me, shakes her head. My wife is very smart, former lawyer, and she says, you can get all this stuff on the internet, which I understand I could do that. I can't get the internet in a cab. I can't get it on the airplane. I like having the box scores in front of me, and it just makes it a lot easier for me when I can actually feel them and touch them.
All right, let's get to some of the actual stories. Roger Clemens, batting against Dwight Gooden in the 1986 All-Star Game, recreate for us the conversation Clemens had with the home plate umpire.
Well, keep in mind, Bill, that Roger Clemens really hadn't batted since high school or maybe a couple times at the University of Texas because, of course, there's a DH all the way through. So now he's batting for, like, the first time in 5 years. And he's in the All-Star game facing Dwight Gooden, who's throwing 98 miles an hour in the prime of his career. So after the first pitch comes through, Roger looks at the home plate umpire and says, "Do I throw that hard?" And the home plate umpire goes, "Yeah, you throw that hard." And Roger kind of went, "Wow," as if to say, nobody can hit that. And that really emboldened him after that to continue to throw fastball after fastball, knowing I've just seen what 98 miles an hour is up close, and I couldn't hit that for $1 million, and neither can anyone else. So that is when he decided, I am a great power pitcher here, and I'm just going to throw it by people.
Now, did you hear that story from Roger Clemens?
I had him repeat it for me. It came originally from Harold Reynolds, and then I took it to Roger and said, "Look, I just want to make sure I have this right." And he basically said, "Yeah, that's what happened." And that's what I did. Most of these stories, I'd say 95% of these stories came directly to me, okay? And that's what made it so special to me. I'm not counting on anybody else here except for me. A few stories, though, I got from other people, and for the most part, I went and double-checked them, and in this case, Roger acknowledged it.
The sending of signs by a manager or a coach and the receiving of those signs by hitters or base runners gives you some very good material. I especially like the strategy that Jim Leland used once when he was managing in the minor leagues.
Yeah, he had a guy on his team who wasn't particularly bright, and Jim Leland confirmed this with me also. So he looks down from the third base coach's box, which is where managers in the minor leagues manage from, and he gives the guy, you know, the bunt sign. And the guy doesn't get it, so Leland has to call him down. So they have a little conference. The guy goes back. Leland gives him another sign. The guy doesn't get it again, so they come back and they meet one more time. And the third time, Leland gives the sign. The guy still doesn't get it, so Leland cups his hands and says, "Bunt!" And the guy at the plate cups his hands and says, "What?" Only in the minor leagues can that happen, and it's beautiful.
Baseball scouts often have great stories to tell, Tim, and they are very useful to teams in a variety of ways, although I guess ex-Cincinnati Reds owner Marge Schott would not agree with me on that.
Right. Marge did not understand what the scouts were all about, and she once said, you know, what do the scouts do? What are they? All they do is go to games. Well, that's kind of the point. When they go to the games, they get to watch the players, and then they can determine if that guy can play or not, if that guy's injured or not, if that guy is fast or not. So when their general manager comes to them and says, what have you seen of this guy? A scout is in a very good position to do this. And speaking of scouts, Bill, maybe my favorite story in the whole book. Well, maybe not, but I love this story. Scout is driving down the highway, and he picks up a hitchhiker. And the hitchhiker says to the scout, "What do you do?" And the scout says, "I'm a scout." And the scout says, "What do you do?" And he says, "I'm a baseball pitcher." And the scout goes, "Oh, really?" So they don't have any bats and balls in the car, which is rare for a scout. But the scout then pulls over to the side of the road where there is an orange grove. And he climbs an orange tree, takes down 25 oranges, and tells this baseball pitcher, "Throw these up against that tree, and I'll tell you if you're a pitcher or not." Now, the guy didn't get signed, but that's not the point. The point is they pulled off to the side of the road. They took oranges down from a tree, and they threw in the middle of an orange orchard to see if this guy could pitch. That's the only scout story you need to know.
Tim, you write of baseball that, quote, "there are more mistakes, miscalculations, and great discoveries than in any other sport." How can you quantify something like that?
Well, I think it's relatively easy to do, Bill, when you look at the number of, say, first-round draft choices who don't even make it to the major leagues. Even some guys who were the number one pick in the country, Steve Chilcutt, Brian Taylor, never even got to the big leagues. Whereas the number one pick in the NFL or the NBA unquestionably not only is going to play in the league, he might even start his first minute he gets there. But in baseball, it's such a crapshoot scouting that if you look at the number of middle round draft choices, high round draft choices who never play a second in the major leagues and compare that to football and basketball, and I have, it's not even close. You can watch a good college basketball player run up and down the floor about 10 times, and you got a pretty good idea if he can play in the NBA. You watch a kid play 20 games at a big-time college baseball program, and you're still not sure if he can even play pro ball, let alone in the big leagues.
At one point, you tell the story of how Earl Weaver, longtime manager of the Baltimore Orioles, humiliated a guy who asked what you characterize in your book as a stupid question, and you say the guy deserved to be humiliated. Why would anybody deserve that?
Well, he didn't. I'm sure I overwrote that a little bit. But Bill, let's be honest. When you go in to a major league clubhouse and you're talking to a Hall of Fame manager, you have to come with something better than what this poor kid came with. He had no idea what he was doing. The thought of me going into an NHL hockey, you know, locker room right now and talking to an NHL player, not going to happen. I don't even understand the game. This kid had no idea what he was doing. And Earl noticed that right away, to the point where he grabbed this kid's microphone and he said, "Look, you're asking all the wrong questions. Now let me show you how to do this." So, of course, in this interview, he pretends to be the interviewer. He pretends to be the kid, and he says, "Now you should ask me, how does our pitching look for this year, Earl?" And then Earl answers the question as Earl Weaver. Then he takes the microphone back and asks another question as the interviewer. I could not bear to watch this humiliation. But again, for all young radio, TV, and writers out there, you better come a little bit more prepared than this poor kid came.
You also write that baseball is the most frightening sport because, and again, I'm quoting here, there is nothing as terrifying and dangerous as a baseball flying at your head at 95 miles an hour. But only one hitter in Major League Baseball history has died as a result of being struck with a pitch. Come on, Tim, how many boxers have died while practicing their trade or shortly thereafter?
Well, here's the difference for me, Bill. First off, a boxer knows he's going to get hit and hit and hit. He's preparing for it. And that's how he prepares his defense. If a hitter goes up there thinking, okay, number one thing, how am I going to get out of the way of this pitch? If you have a safety first attitude like that, you have zero chance to hit in the big leagues. You have zero chance to hit almost anywhere. And I'm telling you, Bill, if you faced anything going 95 miles an hour in your life, I promise you, you will have a slightly different look at this stuff. I mean, baseball is a terrifying sport, even more so to me than going across the middle and catching a football in a football game. I don't discount how scary that can be, but at least you got equipment on. At least you know you're going to get hit. Whereas in baseball, you have something up there completely different. You are up there trying to hit, and trying to stay safe is secondary. Where I maintain in boxing, you have to hit the guy, but you're also trying to defend yourself, and that doesn't work at home plate.
Tim, your love of the game is apparent on every page of this book, which is one of the things that makes it charming. But your love of contemporary baseball notwithstanding, you write, "I like the old way better." Why is that?
Well, there's some things I like better. For instance, I like the old way that general managers used to work, for instance. 30 years ago, 20 years ago, all the general managers were former players who used to hang out in the lobby of the hotel if they were in town. And during the winter meetings, you could talk to every general manager virtually whenever you wanted. All they were doing was floating through the lobby, and you could go talk to them about trades, their players, whatever. Well, now, with the new general managers we have out there, and I'm not being critical of them, I'm just telling you how much I miss this part. They're all up in their hotel suites on their Blackberries and text messaging and using their cell phones or using their computers, and we never see them anymore during the winter meetings. We don't see them as much during games because they're all holed up somewhere. That's the part I miss about general managers. I miss the old-time guys. Not that the new guys are incompetent. It's just that they're much more secretive, and it's not the same old game that it used to be.
You couldn't help but weigh in on Barry Bonds in Is This a Great Game or What? You write that once Bonds retires, you will need the 5 years that must pass before he's eligible for the Hall of Fame in order to decide whether to vote for him. What makes the decision so difficult?
Well, it's because he was already a Hall of Famer through the 1999 season. And the book Game of Shadows tells us that he started doing steroids in the 2000 season. That becomes a complicated problem for a voter such as myself. If he's already in before he started doing this stuff, how do you take him out? And that's basically where I stand right now. If I had to vote today, I would vote for Barry Bonds. I would be about the 40% who would vote for him. The other 60% would say, he's not getting in. The 5 years, this is why they do it, Bill. It's possible we're going to learn an awful lot about Barry Bonds and steroids and a lot of other things in the next 5 or 6 years, and maybe I'll change my mind. My guess is we're not going to learn a whole lot more, and my guess is I'm not going to change my mind, and I'm going to vote for him when he's eligible.
Lots of your fellow baseball writers, including George Will, have praised Is This a Great Game or What? Have you heard from any of the players who might have read it and who might have been mentioned in the book?
I have not heard from any players yet, Bill. They've got other things to do, believe me, than reading books. I've heard some people around the game, some general managers who read the book, and that was really, really nice that they would do that. But I'll have to give the players till the off season for them to sit down and read a book, because I don't think they're the most literary men in the world. And if they don't get to it until November after the season, that's okay.
It's a lot of time to sit around in baseball, Tim.
Well, it's like Andy Van Slyke told his son, don't be an architect. You got to play baseball. There's so much free time to sit around and play cards.
Tim Kirkjian is the author of Is This a Great Game or What?, published by St. Martin's Press. He joined me from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Tim, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much, Bill.
My conversation with Tim Kirkjian will be featured on this week's program. We'll also have a story about a Major League father and son who were both wearing World Series rings, and we'll compare the strategies of the people responsible for publicizing the New York Mets with the efforts of those responsible for telling the world about the New York Yankees. In a shocking departure from baseball, only a game's Karen Given will bring us to the Captain's Cove Rubik's Cube competition in Bridgeport, Connecticut. There you'll thrill to the mastery of the quickest of the cube solvers and learn the unlikely answer to the compelling question, does a Rubik's Cube competition draw groupies? So join us, and remember you can always listen to the show at onlyagame.org.